Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. Newsmakers is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wisi.org/donate or text WISI to 44321. This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. Wisconsin voters consistently rank the economy as the number one issue in the upcoming presidential election. However, they disagree on which candidate would handle it better. We are featuring today a conversation with two of Wisconsin's leading economic experts. They're going to tell us how to understand what's being proposed. We welcome Menzie Chin, who's professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Mike Kenetter, former senior chief economist for Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, correct?
Yes.
And now the CEO of the University of Wisconsin Foundation. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So the economy is such a big topic. We could talk about so many aspects. I want to start by asking you both, what is the status of Wisconsin's economy currently? How are things going in our state?
I think that considering the challenges that have hit the overall U.S. economy, it's been pretty good. We've had continuous employment growth since the pandemic, and that growth is still continuing, albeit slowing, in accord with actually what the Fed wanted overall. We've got most indicators still up. So, for instance, the total wages and salaries that we see, GDP is growing within the state. So, that's not to say there aren't certain problems in terms of some people facing challenges in terms of their own situations and the cost of living, but if I had to characterize it, it would be fairly good.
We're still going. Mike, you agree? Healthy picture in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I'd give it a B+ for the reasons largely that Menzie outlined. Unemployment remains historically very low at 3%. Job growth has been pretty robust, and I would say broad-based across a lot of sectors. Labor force participation rates in Wisconsin are about 3 percentage points higher than nationally.
We're always hardworking here.
We are. I'd say the one thing, you know, real income growth has been a little soft in the state compared to neighboring states, and GDP growth a little bit soft, but still, employment situation is pretty good. But obviously at these low rates of unemployment, you know, if you travel around the state and you want to, you know, visit restaurants, for example, in the touristy areas of the state, good luck
getting
in.
Might have slow service.
Yeah, it's just hard for them to staff right now.
Well, you know, Menzie, you touched on this a little bit. One thing that's been confusing in this election season is that we hear the economic indicators are strong, mm-hmm. but then we hear from voters that they're struggling. Prices are high, groceries high, housing is high. What is this disconnect about?
It is mystifying, I think, to many economists, because by the traditional counts that Mike and I have recounted, you would say that the average voter would say things are going fairly well, particularly with such low unemployment rates. And I don't think there's a complete answer. I think one thing is there's increased polarization in terms of how voters view the state of the economy. So, you know, there's a big switch, even when things don't change very much on the ground, big switch in how Democratic-affiliated and Republican-affiliated voters see the economy. So there's a lot of perception involved. Another thing might be that we had this big bout of inflation after a long period where we had, you know, a pretty low rate of inflation. I mean, it was up to 9% if you count it by the CPI.
So the change was in 2022. Exacerbated.
It was a big change, which a lot of people had not experienced in recent times. So it could be that that was something that, you know, sticks in people's minds more profoundly. And
well, prices,
you know,
are up in some cases 20% from what they were 3 years
right.
ago.
That's right. Groceries prices are about 20% higher than, let's say, in 2020, just at the beginning.
Are there certain segments of the population that are impacted more, do you think, in the economy?
Well, I think everyone experiences the price increases. Some people disproportionately, depending on, your income level, if you have to spend all of your income on just basics, and let's say commodity prices and energy are up, you're going to feel it more. This was an unusual time, though, coming out of the pandemic. Wages actually moved the most in percentage terms at the lower end of the pay scale, kind of nearer the entry level of the labor market, and probably still haven't moved enough given all the problems with finding staffing in leisure and hospitality. But I like to call this the expansion we love to hate, you know, and it is, I think, largely because of the inflation that Menzie mentioned that everybody sees. And I think it is the partisanship. If your party isn't in control of the executive branch, then if you're asked very directly about how the party in control is doing vis-a-vis the economy, it's terrible. If your person is in, it's great. If you look at consumer confidence and consumer sentiment, those numbers are actually pretty strong, judged from, say, the 65-year history of us tracking them. So people are feeling okay when you ask them about the economy devoid of politics, but if you start asking them attached to who's deciding, very different story.
Interesting. I want to ask you about Friday's job numbers. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of anticipation about those numbers. They came out. We learned the U.S. economy added 142,000 jobs over the last month, and that inflation was ticked down just a little bit. Why was this such a big deal?
Well, I think it's a big deal because we've been looking for deceleration in the growth rate of the economy, and the first big reading we have is employment. If you look around, all the other things that you typically see, like income or industrial production, they're coming out in the middle of the month. So early, you know, employment is the biggest thing, and it's a broadest measure. And that's one thing. Another thing is to think about how the Fed looks at it, because there's essentially a reaction function. It's not just what's happening on the ground, it's how you anticipate how the Federal Reserve will react to any bit of news. And in some ways, the slowdown was what the Fed wanted. Maybe it was more than the slowdown. It's hard to say because the Fed's not monolithic. It's a whole bunch of people who are making a decision. The Federal Open Market Committee is 12 voting members. So it's hard to say, but I think they've got the evidence that they have to support cutting interest rates so that we don't push ourselves into a recession. And I think that was so widely anticipated, coming on the heels of the fact that there was this sort of, just to get into the weeds, there's a benchmark revision that comes about once a year. This was the preliminary, and it shaved 818,000 jobs.
That was controversial.
That's controversial, and it's a preliminary benchmark revision, so preliminary is there for a reason, but that means to some extent the economy was slower, growing more slowly than earlier perceived. And so there are these worries that the Fed had waited too long to cut interest rates. So that's why, all put together, there's a lot of attention put to this number.
So how do these jobs numbers and the potential future action of the Fed, how will that impact the politics and the presidential race, do you think?
Mm. Well, let me just, building a little bit on what Menzie just said and then turning to the race implications, I would say, first of all, the number was pretty close to market expectations. It was
a
little,
the
growth in jobs. The expectations were a little higher, came in a little bit soft, but really not much news there. But I think it's such an angsty time because I think markets are kind of on a knife edge. I think everyone thinks the Fed is going to cut rates, but now it's unclear, will they cut 25 or 50? And so that, leads to a lot of repricing and trading and, maybe contributed to the sell-off, I don't know. But I think the Fed doesn't need to be in a huge rush to get inflation back to 2%. I think maybe they overdid it a little bit on the way up, if I had to say it. Not by much, but a little bit. And maybe they can take it down 50 now, but that might be seen as a bit political if it elevated stock markets. So I think it's a tricky decision for
so
that
are there,
reason.
Does this news, is it good news or bad news for either of the candidates?
So I think the impact on the race is really minimal because it was so close to expectations. And I think right now the economy is kind of a push for these candidates. The labor market is still very strong. The stock market is very high relative to its, you know, 5-10 year history. You know, we're near record highs and just came off them. But inflation and high interest rates are kind of a negative for the incumbents. So I think the economy is a push, and I think the real thing is, you know, probably other factors are going to end up being more important in this race, with all due respect to James Carville, who famously said it's the economy,
so
stupid.
So you don't think it's going to be the economy, even though the polls show that?
I think most voters have already made up their mind, and I think it's too easy to tell a story about why your person is better for the economy on both sides. What's very clear are certain other differences between the candidates.
Interesting. And just in case I misspoke, the U.S. economy added 142,000 jobs.
Correct.
In this last month. So candidate proposals. Let's talk about what the candidates are actually proposing on the economy, to your point. And Mike, I want to start out by asking you, since you did work as a senior staff economist under two administrations, what impact on the economy does a president actually have, or his or her administration actually have, over 4 years?
It often depends on whether they also control the Congress with their party. So it's, as you know, it's very hard to get legislation through unless you really have control today. So in divided government, it's fairly negligible. There are certain levers for sure. And I think the other thing that's important to remember is it's often very delayed. You know, the impact that you can have takes many years to really be realized. You can pass something, but that takes time. Implementation takes time. And then for the market participants to really react and see changes in behavior, that takes time. You know, so it's not as simple as looking at how's the economy doing today, and oh, that's because of Biden. You know, we're still in the shadow of a pandemic that, you know, happened before Biden ever came to office.
We don't like to talk about the pandemic.
It happened.
And it had a huge impact on the economy, that's for sure. So let's talk about what Vice President Kamala Harris has proposed on the economy. At a July event in Atlanta, she said, "On day one, I will take on price gouging and bring down costs. We will ban more of those hidden fees and surprise late charges that banks and other companies use to pad their profits. Our plan will lower costs and save many middle-class families thousands of dollars a year." So in this proposal, she's clearly taking on that talking point that people are facing high prices and they're struggling. Mm-hmm. But some of the criticism that I've been reading about has to do with this, that she's actually proposing price controls and that's bad. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what she's actually proposing?
I think she's proposing a series of measures that are more trying to affect the market structure and behavior than actually putting in controls like we would think of, like rent controls or price controls. So for instance, you know, we think about the supermarkets, or more importantly, like the supply chain that's involved in, you know, producing things that go to supermarkets, like meatpacking, for instance. I don't think she's ever said anything like, let's put a price control, but let's look more closely at mergers within the supermarkets in areas where there's only one dominant supermarket, which could exploit its power. Or let's look at the four meatpacking, you know, food processing companies that dominate in that field and how they raised prices. Now, there's a separate question whether you could do anything in time to affect these things so that consumers notice, because anything that's legal, you know, will take months or years to put into play. On the other hand, it's not clear that there's any other counterproposal or alternative proposal for lowering prices. I think President Trump said something like, I will ask my department secretaries to make sure prices are lower, and that was the end of it.
Don't have a lot of other information.
There was nothing else to it.
What's the potential impact of a prohibition on price gouging for consumers?
Let's start with what price gouging is. So just to be clear, I would like all of my prices to be lower too, you know. And the way in a market system prices are fair is competition. In a market setting that has as few imperfections as possible and as good of information as possible. And we've proven in this country that that's a really very powerful system, and it's superior to a system of extreme government intervention like you've seen in the Soviet Union, and even to an intermediate degree, let's say, some European countries that are more heavily regulated. You know, it sounds great to, say, make it costly for firms to fire workers. But what you don't realize is when you do that, then they won't hire workers because they anticipate the costs of having to get rid of workers should that need to be done in the future. So,
is this a realistic proposal from her?
It's realistic if what we're talking about, as Menzies said, is involved in creating more transparency and a market structure that is more conducive to competitive markets. And that's what we should be focused on.
And that
I think the language of price gouging and price controls is kind of demonizing producers, and I just don't think that's ever an effective way to go. But in our partisan world, we're likely to continue to get policies that reward my friends and punish my enemies. Those redistributional policies are almost never good for growth.
All about politics. Let's talk about former President Trump. Mm-hmm. He's talking about bringing costs down for consumers as well, but he mentioned using tariffs as a way to increase revenue. Specifically, he talks about mitigating costs on childcare. During a speech to the Economic Club of New York last Thursday, he was asked about this, and former President Trump said, "They'll have a very substantial tax when they send products into our country, and those numbers are so much bigger than any numbers that we're talking about, including childcare. We're going to be taking in trillions of dollars, and as much as childcare is talked about as being expensive, it's relatively speaking not very expensive compared to the kind of numbers we'll be taking in." Now, the criticism of this proposal is that it will actually lead to increased costs for consumers. What is your understanding of that proposal and the likely impact on consumers?
I think it has almost nothing related to child care, just to be clear. I think economists of all stripes are pretty much united in the view that it would raise prices for consumers and for producers. I mean, if you think about it, it's not a world where things just get shipped from, let's say, China to America and I, as a consumer, buy it. It's China might make a part, Malaysia might make a part, it's sent to another country which then puts it together, which then sends it to America to be inserted into yet another product, which is then finally sold to us. So it's hitting both consumers and producers. Now, former President Trump has said many times that, you know, they'll be paying. Well, they might be paying in terms of the bills coming to them, but they can raise their prices of the goods that are then finally sold to us, the consumers or producers in America. So it's a kind of an empirical question, and the empirics from the last trade war that we had starting in 2018 indicate that almost all of the costs of the tariffs were passed on
the consumers.
And on net, the impact on employment was negative because, sure, you might have produced more steel in the United States because steel was protected, but anybody who was using steel, let's say a car manufacturer, was then seeing higher prices and then would say, well, my costs are higher. Do I want to produce as many cars? On net, it's a pretty bad idea. I think the estimate is something on the order of $2,600 per household, about 3.5 people.
Do tariffs have the potential to bring in trillions of dollars, like former President Trump is talking about?
Sure, they can. But you know, it's ironic that someone who wants to lower the corporate tax rate wants to increase tariffs because, you know, as Menzies pointed out, tariffs will make it more expensive for American companies to do business. It raises their costs because we import a lot of things that go into things that we produce. So it's just, you know, it's politics. It's demonizing foreign producers.
Are they necessary industry protections? Is there a reason why American companies need some fairness?
I think American companies are uber competitive in the industries that matter most. There are some exceptions where we may want to take an interest in making sure we always have some steel production capacity. And there's been a very interesting case where Nippon Steel was looking at acquiring U.S. steel, and it seems like that will be opposed by actually both candidates and by the government. So that's an example where, you know, I would have preferred to see that merger go through. I think Japan is a good ally of ours. I think they're great at producing steel. I think they would invest in the American steel industry just the way they have in autos that are produced here. But, you know, we'll see how that all shakes out. But
well, let's talk about taxes. I want to keep us moving here. Both candidates have different proposals on taxes. You talked about the corporate tax rate. Let's talk about President Trump. He wants to make permanent his 2017 tax cuts. He also wants to reduce that corporate tax rate from 22% to 15%. Can you summarize generally who benefits from former President Trump's tax proposal?
Well, it would be, broadly speaking, higher income households, but corporations in general would benefit from it. I don't think on net, if we're taking out tariffs, it's hard to see what the benefits are accruing to lower income households, because in general, you know, they didn't get a tax cut before, so they're not going to have a tax increase after.
Well, Trump says his tax proposal does benefit everyone. Is there a reason
probably
to believe
not
that?
To the same amount, though, you know,
as higher, compared to the Harris plan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you raise taxes, it hits the highest earners the most because they earn the most income, they pay the most in tax, and vice versa. So I think that's where I would agree with Menzi on that.
Vice President Harris is talking about middle class tax cuts. She says she wants to restore the child tax credit, a new $6,000 credit for low and middle income families with a newborn, also cutting taxes up to $1,500 for low income individuals. She wants to raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. So who are the winners and losers in that proposal?
Well, clearly those are going to be clearly families with children. And if I can say, you know, the child tax credit, it's if you look at the various proposals, it's one of the biggest things in there, if I think about revenue loss to the government, essentially. But on the other hand, it was amazing what it did during the pandemic. We had this expansion, which reduced child poverty by 50%. And so it's a clear example where policies can work. It's such stuff moving around the corners. But it is expensive. And who benefits? It's going to be primarily people that have families and lower incomes.
I asked you this about the other proposal. Is this realistic? She needs Congress to get this done, right?
Yeah, she would. But, you know, is it realistic? Maybe. I mean, we don't know how the congressional race will play out. And you know, we'll
depends
see.
On that balance.
And it's possible that some version of a child tax credit could get bipartisan support. I think children are something that maybe we can all agree could be supported, and that's maybe not quite as difficult to sell, but maybe not as expansive as what she's proposing.
You think these two different tax proposals are messaging or targeting toward different groups in the election?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies.
If I can point out one thing about these tax proposals, if we include tariffs in the tax proposals, tariffs are taxes, that is one area where the president has tremendous power. Its power has been delegated by the Congress to the president over decades and decades because it was seen as too partisan to run through the Congress, essentially. And so President Trump could implement these tariffs pretty much on his own. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you talked about, you know, can a president really affect the economy, I would say that this is the one place where it is possible to have a big effect. And to the extent that I don't believe massive new tariffs are on the table for Vice President Harris, you know, if you're in the do no harm mode, it's one case where there's a clear reason to favor one over the other.
A big topic on voters' minds is also housing, the cost of housing, the cost of rent. The candidate, I guess I want to understand what's happening in the housing market, and will it be getting better anytime soon?
I think the housing market was significantly disrupted by COVID. It really changed quite a bit about where people want to live, caused some relocations to occur because people can work remotely now. In many cases, and so a lot of desirable housing markets have gotten a lot pricier, and it's a market that, you know, there's long time lags to increase supply, and there's also often a lot of local regulatory red tape to new construction. So when these markets kind of get disrupted, it can take a long time for things to play out. The only way to fix it, in my opinion, is to focus on the supply side and try to do what we can to promote employment and training in the trades, try to reduce red tape, try to make sure our materials costs are as low as possible. That generally means no tariffs.
That Fed rate cut might make a difference in the housing market, too?
Well, it certainly could increase the affordability because you don't have to make as many interest payments. But, of course, that means more people will be able to buy houses. And it sort of
increases
the Yeah. So I think, you know, we take these things like, well, can the Fed help? Maybe short term. Can a $25,000 refundable tax credit for first-time owners,
which is what Harris is proposing,
maybe that would help some people buy houses. But what's true is they will increase demand, and you need somehow to enhance supply. And it's not all within the levers of the government. And the Harris plan talks about things where resources devoted to, you know, helping subsidize building new structures and so forth. But a lot of the restrictions come in at the local level. And so the question then is, you know, what can the federal government do except to sort of try to incentivize things to remove zoning restrictions and so forth to enhance over time?
And it's so interesting because, of course, you know, large houses or big houses are something that you'd say, if you're more progressive, it's a bad thing, you know. And we already subsidize housing quite a bit in this country. With mortgage interest deductions, and you know, so why housing? You know, there's a lot of things that you could consider, and you know, to introduce it now, what if I just bought my house a month before this becomes available? Yeah, it's like debt forgiveness on people who all agreed to borrow money to go to college.
I want to end by asking you about tomorrow night's debate. Will be widely watched. I'll ask you both, what's one question you hope the moderator asks these candidates about the economy?
Well, I guess I would say, what are they doing to promote the foundation of our long-term economic success? And I would say that is unambiguously our technological leadership in the world economy is at the foundation of our military, economic, and political leadership in the world. No question about it. This country, 7 of the top 10 companies by market cap, didn't exist 50 years ago. That's the degree of dynamism. Tech companies dominate the American economy, and we need to keep that leadership in order to maintain our position in the world. And, you know, if we don't mind that store and we get distracted by all these redistributional rewards and punishments that have nothing to do with economic growth, we will easily get eclipsed someday by other countries.
What would be a question you'd hope would be asked of those candidates?
I guess it's not separate in a way, but a different way of phrasing from what Mike has put forward. It's like, do we want a sort of stable, cooperative policy framework in which we're thinking long-term about not necessarily conflict, both conflict within the country, but conflict with other countries with whom we traded with whom we have investment with? How do we approach that in a sensible way? And we know that we have challenges. We have national security challenges. Do we want to feel good about beating up countries that we feel are in competition with us? Or do we want to think about what's the most effective way to forward progress for American consumers and producers all together?
Well, we'll have to wait and see if we get some good answers to those questions at tomorrow night's debate. Thank you both for joining us for the conversation today.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Menzie.
And thank you to the viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
Nicolet Bank is honored to support all who strive to make communities great. You have been watching a production of Wisconsin Eye, your unfiltered window into legislative deliberations and public policy programming, where our mission is to provide Wisconsinites an opportunity to access the legislative process and connect with conversations that inform our citizenry. Please consider supporting our mission, and thank you for watching. Wisconsin Eye, policy made public.